Matt Turnauer, director of the new documentary, Where's My Roy Cohen? It just premiered here at the Sundance Film Festival, where we'll be broadcasting all week. Democracy Now! Is accepting applications for a full-time, one-year paid news fellowship. Details online at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Dorote, Maria Studio, and Libby Rainey. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Renee Feltz, Dennis Moynihan, and Aaron Dooley. And to our crew here at Park City TV, Danielle Turner, Robbie Johnson, Diego Romo, Brendan O'Leary, Kristen Parker, Yudibia Barrios, and Jacqueline Daly. To see all of our broadcasts from Sundance, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman from Park City, Utah. Thanks so much for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, January 28th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Kick-Ass, the story of an unnoticed high school student and comic book fan who one day decides to become a superhero, even though he has no powers, training, or meaningful reason to do so. This screening benefits Transitions Project. Again, that's Kick-Ass, showing Monday, January 28th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Real Music Film Festival through February 16th at the Whitfield Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. On Thursday, January 31st, the Real Music Festival will screen the documentary Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band. This film investigates the history and present-day atmosphere of this special art form. Again, that's the Real Music Film Festival, showing Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band, on Thursday, January 31st, at 7 p.m. at the Whitsell Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KABU Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, a Portland comedian harassed by ICE.
The cost of the government shutdown.
And in international news, climate strike protests in Europe.
Good evening. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 28th, 2019. I am Fendi Germany.
And I'm Leslie McLam. This past weekend, local Portland comedian Mohamed El-Sheikhi reported a disturbing incident while boarding a Greyhound bus in Spokane, Washington. El-Sheikhi reports that ICE agents, who did not identify themselves, demanded his ticket and ID. After handing them his Oregon driver's license and work permit, the agents began to interrogate him and others on the bus, who the agents thought looked like immigrants. The agents lied to El-Sheikhi, claiming his papers were forged, but letting him board the bus after an extensive interrogation. El-Sheikhi said the incident seemed to be meant to intimidate and frighten people riding the Greyhound bus. Spokane City Council banned Border Patrol sweeps on Greyhound buses after a number of aggressive sweeps, but the mayor has said the rule cannot be enforced.
The Center for the Constitutional Rights has issued a statement in response to the announcement that the Trump administration will force asylum seekers to remain in Mexico while their applications are being processed. The group says the so-called Remain in Mexico policy is inhumane and unlawful. Rates of violence in U.S.-Mexico border towns are often as high or higher than they are in the countries asylum seekers are fleeing. The group says that the virtual wall this policy creates will separate asylum seekers from their attorneys while forcing them to remain in dangerous situations. The CCR called this Remain in Mexico plan a workaround for the fact that Trump proposed physical wall at the border is now widely seen for what it is. According to the CCR, Trump's proposed border wall is racist, xenophobic, unnecessary, ineffective, inexpensive, and cruel, and widely rejected by the American people.
The federal government shutdown is over, and now the costs of the 35-day partial shutdown are being tallied. The current estimate is that the shutdown cost the U.S. economy $11 billion. The five-week shutdown delayed around $18 billion in federal spending for goods and services and has caused the gross domestic product to fall by 2% points. The full impact of the shutdown will be more clear later this week when the Federal Reserve meets to discuss interest rate policy. The White House chief of staff said today that Trump is willing to shut down the government again if the Democrats in Congress don't agree to fund his border wall by February 15th. Congressmember Hakeem Jeffries, a member of the Democratic leadership in the House, criticized Trump for using the livelihood of government workers as a bargaining chip. Representative Jeffries said that shutdowns are not legitimate negotiating tactics when there's a public policy disagreement between two branches of the government.
A new report by the Immigrant Defense Project found that over the past 2 years of the Trump presidency, arrests of undocumented immigrants in and around New York courts have increased by 1,700%. The study focused only on New York, but other states have noted a similar increase in ICE agents sweeping into courthouses to grab and arrest immigrants, therefore traffic violations or other minor infractions. Here in the Portland area, a number of cases have been documented of ICE agents entering the Multnomah County Courthouse, as well as plainclothes ICE officers in Hillsboro harassing people outside the courthouse who they claim look like immigrants. The expanded courthouse operations have been coupled with increased reports of New York-based immigration agents using physical force to take undocumented immigrants into custody, according to the Immigrant Defense Project.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls are the focus of a bill introduced Friday in Washington's House. As correspondent Emily Schwing reports, the legislation aims to build on a law passed in 2018.
Last year, Washington State Representative Gina Mossbrooker, a Republican from Goldendale, passed a bill that calls on the governor's office and the Washington State Patrol to find a way to count every murdered and/or missing Indigenous woman in the state. A final report is due out this June, but Mossbrooker says she doesn't want to wait.
What we were concerned about was that, one, we would lose awareness on this issue, two, that there's more and more women missing all the time and currently missing.
So she's introducing a new bill that would add two liaisons to the Washington State Patrol to improve government-tribal relations. Mossbrooker also wants to set up a task force and find a way to streamline how missing persons' cases are handled in the state. Mossbrooker has also added an emergency clause. If her bill is signed into law, a 90-day waiting period before it takes effect would be eliminated. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
A state Senate bill recognizes the official indigenous languages in South Dakota, Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota. If passed, the declaration would appear alongside English, recognized as the common language for the state. Lee Strubinger reports.
State Senator Troy Hynert is the prime sponsor of the bill, which seeks to codify those three languages as part of the state's Indian heritage. Democrat Minority Leader Hynert is Sichangu Lakota and represents a district that covers the Rosebud Reservation. Hynert says the languages are about relationships.
Everyone and everything is a relative. And in our language, it reflects that. It puts things in that context that, you know, sometimes we don't often hear in today's society. So, you know, it's important that we start looking at and remembering, you know, that we're all in this together.
Hynert says tribal communities in South Dakota are losing roughly 700 fluent Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota speakers a year, while gaining about 200. He says he hopes the bill reemphasizes the importance of hearing and speaking native languages.
And I think it validates the importance of getting our language out there and being used and accepted. And, you know, you got to remember in our history, you used to get in trouble for speaking, you know, your native language. And I think this shows the opposite of that, that it's supported and needed, and hopefully it'll pass.
If passed, English will remain the common language of the state, which is designated as the language used for any official public document or record. For National Native News, I'm Lee Strubinger in Pierre, South Dakota.
Tribal leaders across the country applauded the end to the partial government shutdown on Friday. Leaders of two of the largest tribes in the U.S. expressed relief of the temporary reopening, but also concerns about long-term impacts and appropriations. Chief Bill John Baker of the Cherokee Nation thanked employees who continued to work during the shutdown and says the tribe hopes the president and Congress will ensure the government remains open. The Cherokee Nation arranged free meals and offered loans. Baker says tribal citizens were concerned about health care, WIC, and food services. The Navajo Nation was also concerned about services and public safety. Vice President of the Navajo Nation, Myron Leiser, says tribes must continue to remind the federal government of its trust and treaty obligations even in times of a shutdown. Friday's deal reopens the government for 3 weeks. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
Support by the Herd Museum, hosting the 29th Annual Hoop Dance World Championship, where you can see more than 80 talented Native hoop dancers vie for the championship title February 9th and 10th. Details at herd.org. Support by Travoy, seeking indigenous artwork to show in Kansas City, Missouri. Up to 6 artists will be chosen. Application deadline is January 31st at travois.com/first-Fridays.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on... At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Sojourner Truth. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy with a low near 35 degrees. Winds will be at a 10 to 20 miles per hour. Tomorrow's weather... Mainly sunny sky with a high of 51 degrees. Winds will be at 10 to 15 miles per hour. Today in history, John Brown organized a raid on Arsenault at Harpo's Ferry, 1858. Also today in history, Philadelphia's Free Africa Society was organized today in 1787. The quote of the day is from I write for those women who do not speak, for those who do not have a voice because they were so terrified, because we are taught to respect fear more than ourselves. We've been taught that silence would save us, but it won't.
Across Europe, nearly 200,000 people marched this weekend to demand climate action. At least 80,000 people marched in a cold rain in Brussels Sunday following a protest of at least 80,000 in France this past Friday. The protesters are demanding that the European Union take urgent and far-reaching action to address the world's climate crisis. The climate strike movement is led by students, many of them in high school, who are trying to challenge the heads of state and government who will attend the European Council Summit in Brussels on the 21st and 22nd of March. The march participants are calling on world leaders to meet the target of a 65% reduction in a greenhouse gas emissions by 2030.
Chemicals have been found in a local woman's garden, and she fears not only for her children, but for the entire city of Portland. KBOO's Rachel Hartley has more.
All right. Hello, Jen. Thank you so much for calling in to talk about this very important topic that's been happening in Southeast. Would you like to let listeners know what exactly went down?
Sure. So I've lived in my house for 20 years, and I live about six blocks from Bullseye Glass. And we were never informed when we bought the house or the whole time that we've been living there that Bullseye Glass had been permitted by the Department of Environmental Quality to basically burn heavy metals 24 hours a day, including lead, cadmium, arsenic, manganese, a lot of other heavy metals, without any kind of really comprehensive filtration system. Mm-hmm. So these aerosolized particulates were going into the air around our neighborhood. And the way that we discovered that this was happening was we heard on the news that the U.S. Forest Service had just done kind of an arbitrary moss study and just decided to do just randomly test for heavy metals in the mosses and the trees around Portland. And they found an alarmingly high amount of arsenic and cadmium in the moss near our house. So I was absolutely stunned to learn this. I learned this February 2nd, I think it was, of 2014. Hmm. And immediately I took my garden soil samples and garden green samples to a certified to see if there were heavy metals in the food because I have a large yard and I'm a very serious gardener, and I've been growing 16 kinds of fruits and many of our fruits and vegetables for, you know, my children's entire life. Mm-hmm. My children have lived within blocks of Bullseye. Before we moved into our current house, we lived just down the street from where we live. So my children were born within blocks of Bullseye their entire lives. Mm-hmm. So anyway, to make a long story short, I was really horrified to learn that although my soil, which I heavily organically amend every year, came back at quote-unquote normal levels for arsenic, lead, cadmium, comparable to other gardens in Portland area, my garden greens, my kale, my chard, came back at unsafe levels, according to the organization and California state standards for cadmium, like significantly unsafe, and also lead. And there's no safe level for lead exposure at all.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, like, for lead, I mean, that's so serious. I mean, how did you feel about your garden being, you know, toxic?
I have two children ever since he was young, has had very serious asthma.
Mm-hmm.
And got older, he's become increasingly ill, and he has several disorders which can be linked with toxic heavy metals exposure. Mm-hmm. In fact, right now he's in pretty serious pain most of the time, and there's very little that can be done for him. We cannot prove that Bullseye caused this, but as I've said over and over again to the Department of Environmental Quality and Oregon Health Authority, is that we know for sure that these heavy metals, breathing them in, eating them, you know, my kids used to go out and pick berries and eat them playing in our backyard. You know, had I been aware that the DEQ had made a special backdoor deal with Bullseye to allow them to pollute like this, I sure as heck would not have stayed in that neighborhood, and I sure as heck would not have fed my children daily from that garden.
Wow, that's absolutely... I'm so sorry to hear about that. And someone who is from Northeast Portland myself, like, I totally understand the joy of being a child and being able to go to like a garden or like a community garden and like feel safe to eat the food that's grown there. And now we have to be cautious when in reality, like, we in Portland, I guess folks don't really feel like we have to be as cautious, but you're telling us that we need to.
Yes, and further, I would suggest that people continue to be concerned about this.
Mm-hmm.
After I found these toxics in my garden greens, I spoke to a plant pathologist, Dr. Robert Amundson, who's from Cornell, and he specialized in studying the effects of pollution on plants. And he said that the reason that my greens might have heavy metals in them, but my soil seemed okay, was not only because I was heavily amending my soil, but because also the greens, just like the mosses on the trees in my neighborhood, will breathe in aerosolized particulates. They're very tiny, those heavy metal particulates.
Get
embedded in the stomata, that's the breathing spiracles of the plant. So they get embedded in that tissue of the plant.
Wow.
And, we were told by the Department of Environmental Quality and Oregon Health Authority that it wasn't a concern to test our greens. And then they changed my mind, like, yes, you should test. But we were never given any support. We were never given any funds. And a lot of misinformation and disinformation was being spouted about, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been very... And, I'm really glad that Bullseye finally decided that they would do the right thing, but I think that it's shameful that they had to be taken to court. I think that it's shameful that they were polluting their neighborhood. They knew they had even a preschool next to their factory. And, you know, they really were aware that these toxics were being pumped out of their building and accreting around the chimneys of their factory. They would send workers up weekly to scrape these toxic metals off of around the chimneys and put it in hazmat barrels. They were completely aware that this was coming out. And I'm really shocked that they were so diffident about the health and safety of their neighbors. And I think, I think it's sad that the settlement is so small compared to the damage. I mean, I have known people who gardened daily who have gotten very serious breast cancer. There have been deaths in our neighborhood. We can't prove that it's Bullseye, but we can be certain that, you know, to breathe this stuff on a daily level and to even ingest it in garden food is, you know, it's hazardous.
Yeah, totally. And I think that you really bring up an awesome point that, you know, even though you aren't able to prove it, you can let KVU know, and we'll at least put it on the air so that people can know this is happening.
Yeah. And I mean, just one more thing that I would like to say.
Yeah, go ahead.
That people should be aware that this issue is far from over. Even if they don't live near Bullseye, Portland's traffic is increasing all the time. We have really serious diesel problem in Portland. In fact, we have some of the most lax diesel laws on the books on the West Coast, and we're breathing a lot of diesel particulates in, and this is well established. And diesel contains cadmium, which causes birth defects, which my son has, and a host of other problems. And so people should be aware, if you're growing food in Portland, especially garden greens, which can really breathe in those and get them embedded, I would get them tested at a certified lab. And you can go to the Oregon State University Extension Service, and they have a list of labs that will test for heavy metals. It's really sad that we're at that state, but it really is important. People should test anyway for lead in their garden soil, which I had done on a periodic basis. But, you know, because I heavily amended my soil wasn't showing what my greens had. So...
yeah, wow. Thank you so much, Jen, and thank you so much for talking to me, and I hope that we find a resolution to toxic chemicals being put in our gardens, okay?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you so much, Jen, and thank you for talking to KBOO. Talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, bye.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 28th, 2019. Here are the main points again. A Portland comedian was harassed by ICE. The cost of the government shutdown. And in international news, the climate strike protests in Europe. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jenka Soderberg. The producer is Rachel Hartley, and our engineer is Mike Fictoklis. The director of the Evening News and Public Affairs is Rachel Hartley. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
I am Findy Germany.
And I'm Leslie McLam, coming up for tomorrow morning on KBOO.
Coming up on Tuesday morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Show. At 9, it's Alternative Radio. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Stage and Studio. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click donate.
I'm Esther Alma. Welcome. You're listening to The Spin. It is that time for an hour where smart is sexy. This Spin, our weekly all-women of color media panel. I'm coming to you live from Star FM Studios in Accra, Ghana. Our contributors are on the line via NPR Washington, D.C. We are on air nationally across the United States and internationally here in Ghana and in London. This program is brought to you by the African American Public Radio Consortium. Today on The Spin, reimagining resistance. From the small screen to the streets, the erasure of black women. For our first discussion, missing black women from the small screen, Oscar-winning writer John Ridley in hot water for his new TV series, Guerrilla. And in part two, missing black girls on the streets of DC and across America. No national headlines, no urgency. Why is media and society so slow to react to and search for missing black girls? All of that coming up. Our contributors this week are Dr. Christina Greer and Kirsten West-Savali. Dr. Christina Greer is Associate Professor of Political Science at Fordham University and the author of Black Ethnics, Race, Immigration, and the Pursuit of the American Dream. Kirsten West Savali is a writer and award-winning journalist, currently serving as editor of TheRoot.com. Welcome, welcome, ladies.
Thanks, Esther.
Thank you, Esther.
Gorilla. That's the name of a new TV series by Oscar winner John Ridley and another award winner who also stars in the series, Idris Elba. It's the story of the Black Power movement in the UK. Excited? So was I. Here's the trailer.
Your government lies to you. It oppresses you.
What we do has to be about ideals.
We want the police to be held accountable.
I beat the drum.
Leaders, if that's what's required, then that's what we'll be.
You're here because you were black. We are the children of the colonies who built this empire on the backs of their labor.
Strong in our pride.
For soldiers and soldiers fight.
It's never black, it's never white.
We're gonna give them something to remember.
Do you tell the police where to find us?
Just trying to keep you from getting killed.
This is the declaration of a state of war.
To the oppressed, know that you don't struggle alone.
Power to the people.
During the Black Power movement in the UK, black women were front and central. They led, they organized, they strategized. And here was a TV show about this movement. Except, there are no black women leads in the series, none. In fact, in a TV series screening, the only black woman is an informant for some racist police. After a screening in London, there was a heated Q&A about this particular issue. Why, asked one black woman, were there no black women leads? One of the male lead actors, black actor Boubou Sese, who plays one of the two male leads, asked her if she read that black women led in the UK's Black Power movement in a book somewhere. The woman said no. Our parents were in the movement, and they told us. So an audience that included the children of the Black Power movement in the UK watched a series that totally erased their mothers. The series creator is John Ridley, an African-American man who, in 2014, won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay for 12 Years a Slave. According to Ridley, this shouldn't be something to get angry about. The central relationship in the series is an interracial one. And he told the audience that was because he is in an interracial relationship. So an African-American man rewrites the history of the Black Power movement in the United Kingdom, in England, because he happens to be in a mixed relationship. The additional larger issue is the erasure of black women from the telling of histories and movements in which they played central roles. The Black Power movement in the UK had women from the Caribbean, from West Africa, especially Nigeria and Ghana, united by a racist system that subjected them to violence, discrimination, and second-class citizenry. The UK movement connects to global black movements in America and in South Africa that battled racist, violent injustice in Kenya, too. When that history is retold in modern narratives on the small screen or the big screen, where black women are matters. That they are there matters. So let's talk missing black women. They're in the history, leading in the movement, overlooked and absent from the small and big screens, telling the story of that history. Dr. Christina Greer, let me start with you.
I'm still just torn, not even torn, but thrown back because on the one hand, you know, we constantly have this conversation about the erasure of women of color in film. And so we're thinking about Scarlett Johansson taking over playing an Asian American and just this complete whitewashing of Hollywood. So we have this, what seems like a unified solidarity conversation about the need to have more women of color on the big screen representing what we can do, our acting chops, etc. But then you have this situation where it is, not only is it deliberate, but Frida Pinto is front and center leading the charge, and granted I have not seen all the movie, I've just seen these extended trailers, you know, assisting these black men and giving them, you know, the confidence and the backbone to stand up to the racist system, when quite honestly it's just not true that this particular incident happened, but to erase black women from that narrative is just a fictitious narrative. So don't even say that it's the Black Panther Party in the UK. Make up a totally different name about what it is, because this is now just complete and total fiction. And so I really want to know the motivation for Ridley, beyond the fact that he's in an interracial relationship. That to me is not an adequate answer to why it is that he felt the need to have almost no black women as leaders in this very important story. And I think that his response is just as bad, if not worse, than the actual erasure of women in the first place.
Kirsted West Savali, your thoughts?
To her point, she's absolutely right. It's adequate only to John Ridley. He has been a man who, you know, I spoke about him in 2014, even with 12 Years a Slave, that Esquire piece where he completely ignored systemic structures of white supremacy, of racism, and he put in his own personal feelings, his own perverted personal feelings about what it is to be a black person. So now we fast forward now, and you see him, and he's injecting his own, his relationship, his personal life to craft these stories that are not reflective of reality. So it's not surprising coming from him. And what I found really, really interesting is why he was so keen to say, you know, this is a reflection. I did it on purpose because of my relationship, and it's important that we show these, you know, this eclectic group of people. But he made sure that black men were visible. I found that really interesting. He did not try to say, well, it's important that we put a strong man of color in the front here. You know, let's make sure we have black men at the forefront here. But, you know, the women are expendable. Let's just put anybody in here. And it doesn't have to be a black woman, because black women's bodies, black women's contributions to movements are just, they're props. They're something that people just use. So I was not surprised by him at all in this instance, but it's sickening, and it does speak to a larger issue.
And I don't think his excuse of, oh, well, you know, Regina King got some Emmys, and, you know, Lupita got an Oscar from movies and projects I've been involved in. It's like, well, we're not talking about those projects. We're talking about this project, where Frida Pinto is essentially corralling these men, and you have women in the audience saying, my mother was in this movement. Why is she not in this alleged nonfiction narrative? Like, I don't understand why he needs to go out of his way to make sure black women aren't in the film. And I'll even give him the lowest common denominator to say they don't need to be top billing in the film. Fine. If you don't want to do that, John Ridley, we're not expecting much from you. However, the fact that there are hardly any at all is so indicative of a much larger systemic institutional problem, because it's not, Esther, our good friend Yaba Blay, who's a frequent guest on your show. We were on a panel last weekend together, and she made it very clear, you don't need white people for white supremacy. And I think that that is a really powerful point. When you look at films like this, it's like, you know, you don't need a white director to erase black women anymore. You can have black directors doing it just as well, if not better, unfortunately.
And what is so heinous for me is the idea that you want to negotiate the role that black women played whilst centralizing yourself. And this is a history that simply could not have happened. These are movements that could not have done what they had done if we were both not there. That the levels of racism that groups of men and women were facing, there's no way these movements would have grown without black women. So I'm just so outraged by the idea that you want to sit and negotiate our right to be front and central. And I do push and say front and central. I do push and say Frida Pinto's character should have been played by a black woman. Now, because I was born in London, I definitely understand when they say that the movement had different people, because the idea in the 70s was to politicize the word black, particularly when people started to look for political representation. But to be clear, and I know that John Ridley knows this, so the idea that you're going to try and navigate your way by using political terms as if anybody is confused is just ridiculous, and don't insult our intelligence. So the idea that you then transpose history for your particular personal trauma or struggle, or your feeling lack of appreciation, I just find that so offensive. What I can't understand is, make your own damn movie if that's what you're going to talk about. Why take a piece of really precious history and litter it with stories that are untrue, offend and insult those people who fought, put their bodies and their lives on their line, whose children are sitting in the audience, to be literally told you were not there? And then the thing that always amazes me about these moments is then when those films are not supported by the people who you decided didn't matter, so they're not in the film, there becomes this additional narrative of the ways in which Black women then do not support the art that Black men make, and as a result of that lack of support, contribute to the failure of the film. This is not a new narrative. I'm outraged afresh just because of the combination of movements. Because I'm thinking, my dad was an activist in the independence movement in Ghana. I'm trying to imagine sitting in a screening of a film where you just erase my mother, who was in the house, who faced the guns of soldiers, and what I would do or feel like if you decided to tell the story of independence and think that there's simply no women in that story. The reality is, though, that is too often how the histories of the movements to liberate Black people from injustice and racist violence have been told again and again and again. We are skilled at the erasure of Black women, and we expect no consequences for that erasure. So then it makes me wonder, do we need to change our strategies of resistance around this reoccurring narrative? We know John Ridley is a serial offender when it comes to this. And the idea that you have the nerve to say, well, Lupita Nyong'o won an Oscar, or this person won an Oscar, as if we're talking about the same thing. Two different nations, two different movements, and each Black woman matters. You can't transpose Lupita's Oscar for Frida Pinto's starring role. I just find that just egregious, honestly. So do we need to reimagine what resistance looks like when it comes to this consistent narrative? Because how tired are we at getting outraged at the erasure of Black women when it comes to the way history is told? Christina Greer.
Well, I think we have to just constantly hold people accountable, and that also includes people who look like us. I mean, we can't just assume that just because John Ridley is an African-American man that he gets it, because clearly he does not. And it's not just erasing Black women, but I go back to my point again, it's the doubling down of refusing to listen when we tell you this is not okay. I can't imagine that, you know, when he screened the film, you know, in its earlier iterations, that this wasn't brought up. I mean, there's so many books about the Black Panther Party that are written by women. This is a well-documented fact. I mean, when Angela Davis wasn't even terribly active in the forefront of the Black Panther movement, but she gets associated with it in many ways. I mean, that's the lowest hanging fruit. Like, start there and work your way forward. I just think it's so intellectually and creatively lazy that he has it, and then using his wife and his relationship as the prop to excuse this particular oversight. That, to me, is offensive. If I were his partner, I'd be offended. I'm offended just as a Black woman because he chooses to sort of say, well, because this is my reality, then I want to put this on the big screen. But then just say it's a fictitious movie and don't say Black Panther Party. Come up with some completely other name and just make it a fun fan fiction. I mean, this is... it's so much deeper than that, though, because we know that also Hollywood rewards this type of behavior. He's not going to be punished for not having Black women front and center, right? No one cares, because we know that Hollywood is too busy trying to whitewash all narratives, and that goes for men and women. And so this is just another accolade that he'll receive, but it's not based in any sort of truth or reality, and per usual, it's on the backs of Black women.
Kirsten Savelli.
It's interesting, because with John Ridley, what he said, even more so than Black women not being front and center, was that it did not matter. You know, as long as there was a woman of color. So not only is the conscious decision to say I'm going to make this film because of the relationship that I'm in, and I purposely want to tell this story because these are the things that we face, he said it didn't matter. As long as there's a strong woman of color there, that's what's important. And I think that really speaks to the kind of diversification of white supremacy. We've seen it all the time. And what we will see is Black men who that proximity to whiteness, that proximity to power and capital, that they so easily just shirk off their Blackness for convenience, for their own personal gain. And we've seen this over and over and over and over again. And you're right. We are always on the front lines. We are the ones giving our time, giving our blood, giving our tears. Our bodies are there all the time, and we're always the ones that are so easily thrown away and erased. And what we see is that this art is a reflection of the reality that we go through every single day.
This is, you know, bringing it back across the pond to our side, Esther. I was in Wall Street yesterday in front of the bull, and, you know, there's the famous fearless little girl staring down the bull, and that, you know, means so much for capitalism and feminism and everything else. And I get what they're trying to say, but it made me so angry because it's clearly, it's a little white girl staring down this bull. And my question was, well, is she one of the 54% that voted for Donald Trump? Is she one of the silent masses that consistently doesn't speak up when it's women of color? You know, and Jason Johnson wrote a great piece in The Root about the attacks on black women in politics right now, and essentially black women have been and continue to be across the globe kryptonite to white supremacy and patriarchy. We are the only group in mass, realistically, that just has not and cannot be co-opted. So the fact that there's this consistent, deliberate effort to erase our stories, to make us invisible, just goes to show you why our resistance is important and necessary, but it also shows you the power and the fear that so many people have of knowing that you have women who just, you can't flash a shiny object in front of us or say some nonsense and think that we're going to get on board. It's just not going to work. So Ridley, the fact that you're saying, oh, well, you all always want women of color and solidarity, I'm giving you that, and now you're complaining, and my wife is, you know, she's one of you guys. It's like, no, you're obviously not paying attention to the nuance, and we're not buying what you're selling.
But you know what? In addition to the white women who voted for Donald Trump, we saw, you know, the pink hats, and we see the white women, I call it the leftist All Lives Matters movement, because we see this idea of there's All Lives Matter on the right, and then you had Bernie Sanders during the election who was talking about let's all get together, or we're all one, something along those lines. So there's this neoliberal push also to erase black women, or to at least say that your blackness is not what defines you. It's your womanhood, because you're a feminist, and these are the issues that we should circle around.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that kind of mentality also leads to someone saying, it doesn't matter if it's a black woman here. She's a woman. She's a woman of
right.
color. So why are you fighting? Isn't this
right.
what
shouldn't
you want?
Shouldn't you be happy, right? Isn't
shouldn't
this
you
what
be
you
happy?
Want that you wanted? And it's like, right,
yeah.
But here's the thing, Bernie Sanders, you have no racial analysis, right? You're clearly not listening to us, because we're not saying that. I mean, I think that's also part of, this has been historically the problem with women's movements, you know, for the past 100 years. You want to erase not just race, and oftentimes class as well, but in doing so, you are consistently saying that black women, in order to be in the club, it's either white women who are leading the club, or you want to be white women to be in the club. And we've consistently said, that's not what we want to do. And it's not just about gender. And so when you have the Bernies and the leftist women with pink hats who are saying, it's really just about gender, everything else falls by the wayside, that's just as egregious as this nonsensical guerrilla film that I won't be seeing.
And it's deceptive, where you had black women, especially around the election in the U.S., who were so easily pit against each other across this idea that there's a Hillary Clinton and you have white women and you have all these women and everybody come together. But let's push race to the back. Why are we being so divisive? You know, we saw that so much. Why are we being divisive? Why does it have to be about race so much? So I think we have to be very, very careful that when there's not a racial analysis, then everything else, it just falls apart. It always has to be there.
And the racial analysis is always there, spoken or unspoken. Even in the call to negate it or disregard it, that's the reality of the power of the racial analysis. The call to continually disregard it, to me, actually, is the recognition of the power that it holds, because it does carry with it, you know, the weight of a deeply traumatic and violent and particular history. And even in the current iteration of the liberation movement, if you think of the Black Lives Movement and the globality of that, even with the reality of the leaderful style of it and it being founded by three queer black women and how that gets rewritten, despite this happening, it's within our generation. We physically know these women. We can see them. It happens again and again and again. So, but this is my question, because the negation has been the narrative, even though the history tells another story. Black women are without exception globally, whether you're here in Ghana, whether you're in Kenya fighting colonialists, whether you're in the Americas fighting the racist state, or whether you're in London fighting Ridley. And by the way, Idris Elba and Babu Sese do not get passes, since Idris Elba's production company was also involved in this. And so the choice to not consult the history for me is inexcusable, since you call it the story of a movement. But I come back to, and I want us to just focus in a little bit more on the way the resistance manifests. Now, I think in many ways, Black women walk resistance. The fact that you can't be co-opted by shiny objects is a manifestation of your resistance. The fact that you won't be seduced or silenced by the consistent attempts to erase you in these cultural spaces where your stories are told, the fact that there is a Q&A, and apparently they were all very taken aback when Black women stood up and said, where are the Black women? Why aren't there any Black leads? And they were genuinely surprised, which just tells me, have you been paying attention to any history anywhere in the world for however long? So then it makes me come back to, the resistance has been something we have done and continue to do. But do we need to look at it again and reimagine what it needs to be? The reason that I ask that is there is no break in the narrative of erasure for Black women. I feel like you go from one set of circumstances, whether it's the Pepsification of protest by that crazy advert that Kendall Jenner was in, the consistent belief that race doesn't matter, despite the degree to which Black women go to say that it does. Is there something else we need to do when it comes to resistance? Kirsten Westervelli.
This has been even more clear going back to the elections here, and the political climate globally really is this push to kind of eradicate the concept of identity politics, right? And so we saw that around race, we see that around gender, we see it where let's just all come together around this particular issue, and that what that does is that pushes the particular needs of Black women always to the bottom, always to the bottom. Because if you have, we're talking about race, then okay, then let's not talk about gender. Let's come together here. We're talking about women. Okay, let's not talk about race. Let's talk about gender. And so what I think, there does definitely need to be a reimagining of how we frame resistance. So of course we have to talk about the issues, but we also have to make sure that we bring our full selves always into a space, that we are Black, that we are women, that our whole selves matter in any space all the time. And so there cannot be any negotiation, there cannot be any bargaining. And that really has to be, I think, central to any kind of resistance that we have going forward.
I just think it's fascinating that so many people tell us that we're focusing too much on race, and oftentimes they are not women of color. So how would you know?
I see that all the time. I hear it so much. I experience so much. And then sometimes that you have people who want to give out cookies, and they want to talk about, you're right, let's come together around these issues and we'll be fine. And it's really detrimental to Black women, to our health, to our souls, to our families, to our bodies all the time, because people want to say, we can take it. We've been taking it. We've been silent, even when we're acting, even when we're moving, even when we're putting our bodies on the line, and we don't complain. And we make it look easy. We make it look okay, and we have to stop making it look easy. We don't need to shut up when we see these erasures, and we need to keep speaking out. So I think we're already doing a whole lot of that, but I just think there does need to be a reimagining of what that means. And when do we choose to opt out?
Absolutely. The notion that identity politics is over is a lie, because we're watching it reimagined, specifically when it comes to white identity politics. That's what Trump's election was about. The notion of making America great again was about whiteness. It echoed the rise and rise and rise of a white diaspora movement, white nationalism in France, in the UK with Brexit. And so it's the idea that, because really what you're saying is, well, it's not that identity doesn't matter, it's just that yours doesn't matter. But ours has always mattered. And why you won't consent and concede that it must be centralized, I just simply don't understand. It's why you get all the backlash to a film like Selma by the wonderful award-winning Ava DuVernay, who simply decides that the story really is of the movement. So it took a movement for Selma to happen. It took a movement to get the legislation that passed the Voting Rights Act. The simple desire to essentially put the story on the screen the way it more likely appeared in the history sent historians like screaming, because the US president wasn't centralized as the hero of the narrative. When I watched the anger towards the film because of that issue, I was reminded again and again and again and again and again. See, it's not true that there's no such thing as identity politics. The identity politics have always been white identity. That's the delusion of what I call post-traumatic master syndrome. You cannot ever not be the master. And if somebody's fighting you and saying, well, actually, hold on a second, not only are you not the master, and you're certainly not the boss of me, that is going to create the kind of tension and friction and reaction we see all the time. So reimagining resistance is not negotiable. It has to be part of the strategy that allows us to think about a finite end to these kinds of conversations. But you know what? Someone needs to say to John Ridley, seriously, dude, wait 1 minute. Just wait a minute. In fact, you know what? Ray J, you tell him.
Ray J, Lil Kim, get it together.
Wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, hey. Girl, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, hey.
And honestly, the reality is we cannot afford to wait. Life is too short. We just can't wait. Ultimately, we, black women, black people, have to get back to real life. Back to reality.
Back to life. Back to reality. Back to life. Back to reality. Back to life. Back to reality. Back to the here and now, yeah. Show me how decide what you want from me. Tell me maybe I could be there for you. However do you want me? However do you need me? However do you want me? However do you need me? However do you want me? However do you need me? However do you want me? However do you need me?
I was born in London, and it had a large and still has a large Jamaican community. And taking a trip into Brixton, which is in South London, for my friend's parents was like going back home to Jamaica, to Kingston. And for women like Olive Morris, who founded the Brixton Black Women's Group back in the 70s, Brixton, which was kind of like Jamaica, was home and horror, also known as Jamrock.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Multnomah County Central Library in Portland. Golden Years in the Red with Student Debt will feature informational speakers and people who will share their stories about debt, including garnishment of Social Security checks for student debt when grandparents and parents co-sign student loans. Again, that's Golden Years in the Red on Tuesday, January 29th at 5:30 p.m. at the Central Library, 810 Southwest 10th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
K KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. The Cascade Festival of African Films represent different countries and cultures and a range of lifestyles from pre-colonial to modern times, including both rural and urban settings. Films include Razzia, a film from Morocco, and more at the Hollywood Theater, and Wale from Burkina Faso, Fig Tree from Ethiopia, shorts from emerging African filmmakers, and many more at the Moriarty Arts and Humanities Building, Room 104, at the PCC Cascade Campus, 705 North Killingsworth Street in Portland. Again, that's the 29th Annual Cascade Festival of African Films from Friday, February 1st through Saturday, March 2nd. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium in Portland. Films showing this year include Mr. Soul, The Ballad of Shirley Collins, Solo, The Evolution of the One-Man Band, Gospel According to Al Green, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest Film Center's Real Music Festival from January 18th through February 16th at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 6 p.m. It is time for Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio. This is Jamie Partridge, your host. Tonight we're talking with ATI Steelworkers, organizing a union for unity and strength. Our guests are Nick Gaitau. Hey, Nick. Say hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
All right.
Thanks for having us.
All right. Justin Harry. Justin?
Hey.
Hey. And Dan Hoskins.
Hi.
So this is Labor Radio of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. And tonight we're talking about the ATI male family.